Okay, welcome back, podcast fans. I'm your host, Annette Hines, and this is Parenting Impossible, the Special Needs Survival Podcast. And we are back in our series of getting ready for school. And as you are preparing for those IEPs and getting refreshed on all the things that you need to have in place, we are talking today on a very important subject, and that is all about sensory processing disorder. Wow. So this is something that I never thought that I would really ever need to know much about until my own kid got diagnosed with it. And I won't tell you how many years ago that was, but I'm excited to have with me today some wonderful gals, Rachel Harrington and Jessica Hill, who have a lot of letters after their name. I'm going to like garble them all up, but we're going to talk about what all those letters mean. And they have this great company called Harkla. I don't know. Am I saying that right, ladies? Harkla?
Yes.
Harkla? Okay. And they have some wonderful products and some wonderful strategies and tips, as well as just some great advice for caregivers, parents, families, and individuals. And we're going to get into it all today. So welcome, ladies. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
All right. So I have so many questions. I think we should just start at the beginning. First and foremost, I know that you are certified occupational therapist assistants, right?
Yes.
CODAs.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? What is that designation? What is that all about?
Yeah, so most people are familiar with occupational therapy and generally occupational therapists. And so they are responsible for doing the initial evaluations and really intaking the patient. And then generally the clients will get put onto our caseloads as the occupational therapy assistants. And we carry out the treatment plan. We see the children, see our clients weekly, as often as required by the treatment plan, but we are generally just experiencing a play-based treatment session with our clients and participating and hanging out with our kiddos. And it's really fun being a CODA.
So you're the person that they would actually see in implementing the plan of care or the treatment plan, as opposed to the occupational therapist who would, you know, provide the plan. You're going to be in real time sort of making the adjustments and doing the day to day with them, whether it's in the school setting or hospital setting or clinical setting, whatever it may be. Is that right?
Yes, but that's not to say that the OT who does the initial evaluation can't see the child for treatment, because that does happen in a lot of settings as well. And in most of the settings that we've been in, it's kind of a combination of the OT who does the initial evaluation might also have a couple of kids on their caseload. But what it means mostly is that the CODA does not do the initial evaluation and paperwork.
Okay. So a lot of people get really bent out of shape about the fact that they're not getting the occupational therapist, the real therapist, to see their kids. What do you have to say about that?
You know, it's valid. I try to put myself in their shoes as a mom myself. And if I were to go to therapy, you know, and someone is doing an evaluation on my child, I'd say, well, why aren't you going to see my child? And really my thought on it is, if you don't want me to work with your child because of my credentials and my background, that's okay. That's your choice. I really feel like you're missing out, because our experience is solely working with children. And we are the ones who are creatively setting up the activities to work on the goals. And that's really our expertise, is to work one-on-one with these children. So I understand that people can get kind of bent up and out of shape about that, but it's our job. You know, that's what we're trained to do. And I think sometimes just taking a step back and realizing that for the most part, we're really good at what we do. And that's what we're trained to do. So just having that open conversation with the occupational therapist and with the CODA, I think is the most beneficial thing that I can recommend a parent to do.
And isn't it really best if you're all working together as a treatment team?
Yeah. And that's exactly what we do. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So Rachel, you also have the designation of having an autism certificate, and that's a little bit newer. I've seen that with a bunch of professionals. That's something extra that you can do as someone who's interested in working with people with autism. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I don't know if it's new or not. I mean, I think it's been at least 5 years since I've had that, maybe longer. It's through a company called IBCCES, I believe. And it's the version of the CAS, so the Certified Autism Specialist, that an occupational therapist can get. As a CODA, I can get my autism certificate. And so it basically means that I take additional continuing education units each year that focus on autism and treating clients who are autistic. And so really it's just a designation of, yep, I've done additional training in autism and working with clients who are autistic.
That's going to be really important as we get into the next part of the conversation, because some of the things that we're going to talk about are not going to be just about autism, but are going to be particularly important when it comes to people with autism diagnoses. So as we started talking before I hit the record button, you started telling me about new credentials that the two of you have that I was fascinated to hear about. I'm not even going to try to get these new letters right. Can you tell me about the new credentials that you have?
Yeah, so the letters are CPRCS, and it's Certified Primitive Reflex Clinical Specialist. So we kind of similar to the autism certificate that Rachel has, it designates that we have done a certain amount of continuing education in primitive reflexes. And in order to maintain those letters and that certification, we have to continue to take courses and learn more about primitive reflexes every year. And so it shows that we have a lot of experience working with primitive reflexes.
So this is a part of what you do that is fascinating to me. So I was looking at, well, your website, for example. Audience, you have to go to their website, and I'll have all of their links in the show notes. You must go there. So much great information. But talk to me about primitive reflexes. So much information I never knew. You remarked that up to 89% of children have them. What is this all about? Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, primitive reflexes are really neat because everyone's born with them. Everyone has primitive reflexes. They are kind of created, they're initiated in utero when the baby is developing during pregnancy. They're often used and kickstarted during the birthing process, and they help keep the infant safe when they're first born, and they really don't have any, survival skills. So the kicker with the reflexes is that they need to go away or integrate or mature into higher level skills and higher level cognitive patterns and experiences. But sometimes that doesn't happen for a variety of reasons. When those reflexes kind of get stuck in the body or that lower brain stem area, they cause a lot of symptoms that look like other diagnoses, or they just cause a lot of their own issues, things like anxiety, balance, coordination challenges, visual challenges, ocular motor challenges, anxiety, bedwetting, left to right discrepancy challenges. Did I say reading and writing, copying from the board?
No.
Dyslexia, ADHD. I mean, honestly, the list is so long. And our goal is really to help parents, practitioners, therapists identify okay, is this the root cause of the challenge that your child or your client is having? If it is, let's address those reflexes and integrate them. And then we can see what else we need to work on. Do we need to work on more of the sensory integration? Do we need to work on more of the dyslexia? And so it's really kind of that root cause approach that we like to take.
Ladies, this is so fascinating. I can think of dozens of children that I have known, and even young adults
who
I can identify, you know, things in their reactions and, you know, sort of their patterns, their life patterns that have me questioning, you know, in reading some of your materials and thinking about what you're saying here. And I bet half of our audience is nodding their head right now and going, you know, so fascinating, really, just brilliant. And where can people find out more about the science behind this? And then, you know, once you answer that question, I've got another follow-up question to that. So where can people find out more about this?
We do have a lot of resources on our website, harkla.co. We have blog posts on several of the primitive reflexes that describe what the primitive reflex is, why it's important in infancy, what can happen when it doesn't integrate. And then the blog post also provides some tips and tricks for what parents or educators or therapists can do to get started. Those blog posts are free, which is why they're great. We also have a free webinar that anyone can sign up and watch. It's also on our website. We always like to promote our free products first, just because it's the easiest to access.
Sure. Yeah, podcast episodes, lots of podcast episodes. Our podcast is All Things Sensory. And then we do have a full course as well, if someone wants to jump in and learn how to test for reflexes, integrate them, and kind of the whole gamut. And then kind of finding some of that research, we include a lot of the most recent research. And with that course, it's AOTA, it includes AOTA CEUs. So it requires what's called level one evidence, which is the most recent evidence, as well as the specific types of articles used to support it. And so you can, I mean, anyone can go to Google Scholar and search primitive reflexes and just start reading up on some of the information. I just find it so fascinating.
Yeah. So you're providing information for family members and for professionals alike.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful. And what would be, you know, just an example of a tip or an idea to help?
Like if a reflex is retained?
Mm-hmm.
I would say the biggest thing would be to, for any reflex, my go-to is always to get down on the floor. Crawling is a really beneficial tool, whether a baby is crawling, whether it's a toddler, a young child, an adult. Crawling is like an innate skill that is so beneficial for reflex integration. So I would say get down on the floor and crawl, get down on the floor and play with your kids, lay on your tummy, lay prone, strengthen your neck, strengthen your core, and do yoga. That would be, so there's three.
Yoga.
Sorry, I can't just do one. Yoga is really beneficial too.
So even if you're an adult with a disability and you haven't done that full integration, you can still work on this.
Yes, because primitive reflexes live in our brain, and we know that our brains are plastic. They can change at any time. And so anyone of any age can integrate these primitive reflexes even later in life, because the brain can create those new neural pathways to integrate these reflexes at any time.
That is so hopeful. Yes. Well, I could talk to you just on that topic for a day, but I really, really want to move on a little bit, not a little bit, a lot, because I need to talk to you about what SPD is. So I never knew anything about this until I had a 29-week preemie. As you can imagine, therein, you know, was almost a guarantee of having a kid with sensory processing disorder. Most preemies are going to have that or they have a high likelihood of having a sensory processing disorder. So explain for our audience who may not know, what is sensory processing disorder?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody. Have you been searching for a law firm that understands the unique challenges of your family? We can help. My name is Annette Hines, and I'm a mom and an attorney. And I'm also an advocate. And I started Special Needs Law Group because when my family was young, I struggled to find all the services and support that my family needed. We can help here at Special Needs Law Group with special needs trusts, guardianships, and maybe you aren't even sure what you need yet, and we can help with that too. Book a free call today. You can either use our link in the show notes, or you can go to www.specialneeds-law.com. See you soon.
Yeah, sensory processing disorder, first and foremost, unfortunately, it isn't. True sensory processing disorder isn't a recognized diagnosis in the DSM-5. So when we refer to it, when we're just kind of casually talking about it, we'll say sensory processing challenges. And just know that I'm kind of using all the same terms here. It's all under the same umbrella, but it's really when our brain and our body, they aren't processing the 8 different senses that we have. You might be aware of the 5 common senses, but we do have 3 hidden senses that I think are the most impactful for daily functioning: proprioceptive, vestibular, and interoception. And these really help us identify where we are in space, in relation to our surroundings and our environment. And when those messages from the environment, from our body, are almost like getting into a traffic jam, or if they are misfiring, they're being sent to the wrong place in our brain, we're either craving more input, or we're avoidant and we're hesitant of certain input. So maybe we are hesitant of loud sounds, or maybe we're craving movement so much, our body just needs more movement in order to feel satisfied. So that's kind of sensory processing challenges in a nutshell. You can have different sensory processing abilities for each of those 8 senses. It's not all going to be, you know, highly sensitive to all these senses or under responsive and sensory seeking to all of these senses. Generally, there's a mixed response.
And the trick with SPD also is that it has to negatively impact daily functioning. So we like to say that we all have a sensory system. We all have sensory quirks and different things that we crave or don't need as much of. But if it's not negatively impacting our ability to get through our day, we don't necessarily need to address it. We would just call it a sensory quirk. But true SPD is when those challenges with sensory processing are significantly impacting your ability to get through your day or your child's ability to get through their day.
Oh, excellent description. That's very helpful. So who would be the person or the professional in your life that would identify this for you? Is it always an OT?
Generally, yes. You can go to your primary care physician, pediatrician. You can say, hey, I'm noticing these challenges. If you take like a sensory checklist, you can bring it to them and say, these are the challenges that I'm noticing. Then there would be a referral to occupational therapy where the therapist would say, okay, this is what I'm noticing. These are the challenges. But because it's not like a true diagnosis in the DSM-5, insurance doesn't cover it. So that's why generally therapists are working on other challenges and other diagnoses with underlying, you know, focus on sensory.
Does there often come SPD with other challenges?
Absolutely.
Often, yes. But it can be a standalone, you know, quote unquote diagnosis as well.
Okay. Where does one find that sensory checklist?
Sensational Brain has several different free checklists for parents, for educators, for therapists, for teenagers to fill out. And they're just download and free to use.
Okay, super. So, before we move on to sensory diets, which is such an important topic, can we talk about some strategies and, some exercises for working on these things? What if somebody doesn't have the ability to work with an OT? Are there things that people can do, kind of on their own to work with their child? For example, we used to do brushing techniques. That was something that we worked on. I used to do light massage. There were little things that we could do at home with my daughter, Elizabeth. What are some tips that you would recommend?
Yeah, honestly, I would start. There's a couple of great books that we could recommend too that are great for providing activities and strategies that aren't necessarily required to do so with an occupational therapist. One of my favorites right now for adults with sensory challenges is called Too Loud, Too Bright, Too Fast, Too Tight. And that's a great one because it does talk a lot about the brushing. It talks a lot about therapeutic music. It talks a lot about, adult sensory diets, movement activities, and things like that. And then for kids, we always love Raising a Sensory Smart Child and The Out of Sync Child. Those are two really great books.
And then there's actually also a companion book, The Out of Sync Child Has Fun, and that is a book just full of sensory activities.
Okay. Because we're really talking about getting ready for school or, that first month or two of school and kind of dealing with school districts and adjusting and new environments. And it's always hard, at the beginning of a school year with the new class and the new teacher and the new this and the new that. What kind of tips can you give parents or even the kids for advocating for what they need? It's very hard to get services written into an IEP. So sometimes we just need help with adapting an environment that works. What would you advise parents? What help could you offer?
My first thought is to start the day in a way that helps set the child up for success. So, meeting their sensory threshold in the morning before they go to school. This means if your child is a sensory seeker and they seek out a lot of jumping, crashing, swinging, running, lots of full body movements, then create a morning sensory diet routine that involves all of those different things, maybe outside if possible, but you can use all of your household objects like the couch and the cushions and blankets and chairs to create an obstacle course where they can meet their sensory needs before they have to go to school and sit for a long period of time.
Yeah, and going along with that, once they're at school, I think teaching children about their sensory needs, if possible, is really helpful. And being able to request a movement break or being able to request adaptive seating, so maybe sitting on a therapy ball or a standing desk, making sure that we're not taking away recess because recess is like the most beautiful reset button for kids, and especially kids with like high sensory thresholds who need more input. Making sure that we are being cautious of how much time we're requiring these children to sit and remembering that children learn through movement. So whenever we can incorporate a lesson in like a multi-sensory fashion, that we should be doing that. Like, if we're working on math, squirt shaving cream on the desks and they can do their math activities in shaving cream, or turn the metronome on and do spelling words with the beat of the metronome, or crawl around the classroom for younger classrooms, crawl around the classroom with a song in between different subjects. So really being strategic about incorporating the different senses into the classroom, I would say that would be my next recommendation.
And then I did have another thought because oftentimes we'll hear from parents who say that after school, their child melts down, You know, maybe they are able to hold it together at school, but then once they come home, they can't hold it together anymore. And I experienced that with my own child. And so creating a safe space, we call it a sensory corner or a calm down corner in the home where your child can go to decompress after a long day at school, making sure there's water, maybe some crunchy snacks available, maybe some music or some different lighting options, different things in this like calm down space, corner, pop-up tent, whatever it is that the child can go to for 20 to 30 minutes, however long they need after school to just decompress and let it all out versus, you know, what I used to do with my son, and this is why he was having meltdowns, was ask him tons of questions about how his day was and what he wants to do and all these things. And it was just bombarding him with too much after school. So have your child come home, give them a snack, let them decompress, wait to ask them all of the questions until later on in the evening.
That is such a lovely idea. You guys are full of great suggestions for the kids, for the parents, and for all of the school professionals as well. I hope they're listening.
Dakota's, that's what we do best, those hands-on activities and treatment
exactly.
ideas.
Exactly. Sometimes, though, it's really hard for the school professionals because they have a lot of good ideas, but they don't have a lot of freedom to implement them, you know, through their administrations. Okay, so I'm really interested in this idea about sensory diets. Tell me about sensory diets.
Yeah, sensory diets are really, I mean, it's a term coined by like in occupational therapy, but oftentimes we'll refer to it as like a sensory lifestyle or a sensory what do we call it? What's another word that we call it?
Sensory experience.
Sensory experience. Just, it's really coordinated sensory activities, very specific sensory activities in a specific order consistently throughout the day. So our goal here is to provide the input to the child or to the adult, the input that their body is craving, even the input that they're avoiding, in order for their nervous system to really like get fueled and to meet the need that they're missing out on. Because what I like to have people envision is for a child who's maybe craving input, they're moving, they're jumping, they're wiggling so much, their right. body is just trying to feel normal. They're just trying to feel satisfied. And just imagine, you know, having to sit all day and you want to move, but you can't. That's kind of what it feels like for a sensory seeker who just needs that input in order to feel satisfied. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, for a kiddo who is more highly sensitive or a sensory avoider, they are, you know, I like to think of the nails on the chalkboard, that visceral reaction down your spine to the sound of, you know, the air dryer going off in the bathroom or the toilet flushing. Right. They're really getting that visceral reaction. So when we implement a sensory diet, we are helping that sensory system to just feel and function at its best. We're not trying to cure sensory processing disorder. We're just trying to help the child grow into their sensory system.
Okay. So how do you create a sensory diet? What does that look like? Like, how do you start with that?
Yeah, the golden question, like Rachel said. You can use those free checklists that we mentioned earlier from Sensational Brain. And this gives you an idea of what types of sensory input your child seeks out throughout the day. And yeah. that can give you a better idea of what to incorporate more into the daily routine. But if you have a sensory seeker, then you likely want to incorporate more movement activities, more heavy work activities. So anything that requires the use of their muscles. Unfortunately, there's no one size fits all approach with right. sensory diets. Oftentimes it's trial and error to see what works. But if you can come up with two or three activities, sensory activities, crawling, jumping and crashing that your child enjoys and incorporate those into the daily routine more often, that could be a sensory diet.
How do you get all of the people that are in charge, like the whole team, on board? Because it doesn't really work, does it, if you can't get the school on board and the babysitter on board and the grandparents on board? How do you do that?
I really think the first trick is communication. And instead of saying, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to do it, this is when we're going to do it, and this is why we're going to do it, we can explain it more of like, this is something that we have seen to be really helpful for Johnny. We're make it as easy as possible, whether that is a laminated, visual card, a key ring with activities on it that goes with Johnny at all times. Making sure that the education is really there before we're implementing the sensory diet. So I would say communication is key, whether it's email, whether it's something laminated that can go with him at all times, and just making sure that everyone is on board. Because yeah, that's honestly, I'd say 75% of the battle is getting everyone to participate in it. And it's not going to be perfect, and that's okay. But just know that we're going to benefit Johnny when we are giving him more sensory input consistently throughout the day.
Well, ladies, you are some kind of awesome, let me tell you. So, I think the key for parents always, as you know, because you are parents, as am I, is to not take on too much at once, right? Because it can be so overwhelming. And we don't want anybody listening to this podcast to feel overwhelmed and to feel like they, are taking on too much or just can't do it. So I would love to leave this podcast with, what is the best, just first thing, the first step that somebody can do? There's so much information on your website. There's so much there. There's the podcast and there's, webinar and there's all kinds of stuff. And people could just gobble it all up. And some people will, because they are information Pac-Mans, But then there are people like me who would take a look at it and I would have crumbled when my kids were little, because, yeah, I just would have so much. So I just want to give people just like one thing, that first step, so that they can just start and feel good about that. What do you think?
The first thing that comes to mind for me, I always say empathy. So I would say starting by taking a sensory checklist, taking the sensory checklist we mentioned, and that way you can at least see visually what your child or what you want yourself, what your sensory preferences are. Once you can see it, it's so much easier to just be like, oh, okay, that's why I was doing this, or that's why my child's doing this. And it just validates everything. And you don't have to do anything with that information initially. Just let it sink in, let it marinate, and just put it on the fridge and just have it in the background. I would say that would be, if you take anything away, start there so that way you can really begin to empathize and understand your child's sensory preferences.
Yeah, I like that. Like understanding the why behind your child's behavior, essentially. My thought was to connect with your child. So, as parents, we often are overstimulated ourselves, but
Oh,
we have to,
yes.
yes. But we have to understand that our children need us to help them, right? They can't do this on their own. So we need to be able to connect with our child. And in order to do that, we have to regulate ourselves first. So we need to use sensory strategies for ourselves, like go for a walk, chew some gum, do some yoga, do something to help yourself feel more regulated and calm so that when your child is struggling, you can better connect with them to help them also feel better.
I love that.
Oh my
Love
God, I love that. That is so great. I remember on this podcast, a couple of times I said that we cannot expect our kids to be happy people if we do not show them how to be happy people ourselves, right?
Yeah.
It's our job to exhibit what it is to be a happy person. And, you can't just tell your kids, go out and be happy. I mean, And this is exactly what I was talking about. And I just love that advice. I think both pieces of advice, they are actually the same thing. You're both saying the same thing, like getting that information and sitting with it, and then actually doing something yourself to be an example of what it means to have some good regulation of your own anxiety, your own busyness of your brain. That's fantastic. What a great note to end this podcast on. Thank you so much. You ladies are just amazing and fantastic. I love it. And I love what you've built here. So can you tell us your website again? What is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you can find it at, everything is on harkla.co, harkla.co. And you can just search for anything there. And we've got products, courses, freebies, blogs, everything.
Well, thank you so much for making so much available for free to our disability community. That's wonderful. It's definitely, you know, in my own heart, you know, what I try to do as well. I love what you're doing, and I learned a lot today. So I really appreciate it. It's been great talking to you, and thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Annette.
Really good to meet you.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I just wanted to take a second to say how much I appreciate you taking the time to listen to these podcasts. I'm having a blast doing them, and I hope that you're finding the content to be what you were really hoping. If you are, please take a second to leave a rating and a review. It's so helpful in getting this content out to people who really need to hear it. Thank you so much.